This is the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 29th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this week we're going to take a look at a few developments. We have some additional guidance on the employee retention credit, some clarifications in an IRS FAQ. We'll discuss a little bit about the formal IFR the SBA released about the forgiveness rules following the Paycheck Protection Program Flexibility Act, and talk about the limits on owners' payroll costs. The IRS finalized regulations under 199 Cap A. You may have forgotten what's even out there as proposed regulations, but we'll discuss what they put in there. The IRS also proposed regulations on the parking lot tax. See, we're beginning back in Tax Cuts and Jobs Act things now. Things are getting back to quasi-normal in some parts. So we'll talk about the parking lot tax. It mainly formalizes the guidance we had before, gives us a couple of additional rules, and does provide one especially important change that allows us to figure out how much of a combined rent that we're paying for a building that has a parking lot attached is considered parking area. We have a safe harbor calculation now that we can use for that, and that's probably one of the bigger things in the proposed regs. We also have a discussion of the rollover issues for those required minimum distributions to start the year that weren't RMDs. And while it's very likely the IRS overstepped their authority by granting relief here, I also expect nobody will complain. And finally, we'll talk about an obscure provision that the IRS announced this week is going to end up giving your clients who are filing their returns here by July 15th, they'll actually be paid interest on the period from April 15th to July 15th if they have a refund coming. And we'll talk a little bit about why that's so with this year's rules, and also, you know, how that's going to affect your clients. But let's go ahead and let's get to our first development this week. This is on the IRS's FAQs for employee retention credit under the CARES Act on the IRS website. It was posted actually on the 19th of June. And the IRS posted a number of clarifications here. Some of the big things they did was added a number of examples that help clarify. Now, let's remember what this whole thing was about. The ERC is only available for employers who essentially did not get a PPP loan. If you got a PPP loan, or I should say if you got a PPP loan forgiven, all right, yeah, you know, in this case, got to get it right. This one was just getting a loan. So you have to remember what's what. If you got a PPP loan and you didn't pay it back by the final extended date, which, as I recall, we go way back to what this was under those crazy rules. But if you didn't pay it back by May the 18th, now I remember, now I got the date, found it. If you didn't pay it back by May the 18th and you've held on the loan after that date, you don't qualify for this. So for a lot of your clients, you're going to be skipping this one. But if your client did not go for the PPP loan program, then this is a secondary level of relief. And this particular relief covers employers who have wages paid after March 12th of 2020 and before January 1st of 2021. And you qualify for this either during what I'll call a suspension period or a decline in revenue period. Now, the suspension period is if you fully or partially suspend operations due to 2020 due to government orders that limited commerce, travel, or group meetings for commercial, social, religious, or other purposes due to COVID-19. So, for instance, you're under a shelter-at-home rule, right, stay-at-home rule. That would be a covered area. You'd be under those issues. If your employee is not allowed to come to the office, you're not considered to be an essential business, you can't operate because, let's say, you're a barber shop or something, it's a little tough to do that by telework. So this would be the shutdown rule. It also, for partial shutdowns, would include where we're telling restaurants that they can't have sit-down, right? Or they can only have a small portion of their sit-down area. So that qualifies there. For those periods, we're under those government rules, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means because that's what this helps us understand. Or we have the significant decline in revenues. And that means we start with the first quarter in 2020 where revenues are less than 50% of that same quarter back in 19. And then we continue on until the quarter after, or until the end of the year, or the quarter after the quarter in which our revenues get back to 80% of 2019. So again, only for people that did not take a PPP loan, or at least if they took it, they gave it back by May the 18th. Because remember, for a while, the SBA allowed you to return your PPP loan money, and some people did. So let's talk about how this works now. So key issue here is what exactly counts as a government order under these rules. And according to the FAQ, they added a modified question 28 to hopefully clarify this matter. And generally, a government order, it has to be mandatory. So they'll say some of the examples of this be an order from the city's mayor stating that all non-essential businesses must close for a specified period. A state's emergency proclamations that residents must shelter in place for a specified period other than those who are employed by an essential business and who may travel to and work at the work-based location. An order from a local official imposing a curfew on residents that impacts your operating hours, so you're not allowed to operate, you have to shut down for some reason. Or an order from a local health department mandating workplace closure for cleaning and disinfecting. Now, the key issue on these, all of these are mandatory. If it's not mandatory but advisory, then it's not a full or partial shutdown, even if you're following the guidance. And why that can be important is, let's take the example here in the state of Arizona. Until last week, we had advisory guidance to businesses, generally, or at least it seems that's how it was worded, for what you had to do if you reopened. Right, and there are certain requirements, certain restrictions you're supposed to follow, etc. Now, last week, due to the increasing number of COVID-19 infections in the state of Arizona, we now have the highest rates as far as per 100,000 population going right now. So, hey, we're number one. Anyway, but under that theory, we're still there, and rising hospitalizations. So we have a few issues. Yeah, our positive rates on tests are insanely above anybody else's right now. So yeah, we have a little problem going on here. So now we have those rules went from advisory, you know, this would be helpful, to mandatory. So if that mandatory rule now forces you to shut down, you would be under a full or partial shutdown, and it could be a partial more likely following those rules. That would be state mandated, effective with the governor's proclamation that was issued last week. So it's quirky, and you got to watch the exact circumstance in your state and locality and what's exactly mandated, because that's crucial here. And they do give us some examples here. So they talk about the simple case here is the governor mandates that all non-essential businesses must close on March 20 until April 30. And this includes a whole list of things that are non-essential, like a movie theater, let's say a chiropractor, a bowling alley. Those are all things you're not going to be able to do from home. So that would be considered to be a government order. However, the second example says the mayor of the city holds a news conference at which the mayor encourages residents to practice social distancing to prevent the spread of COVID-19. That's not an order limiting commerce, travel, or group meetings. It's not mandatory. They're just advising you to do it. And secondly, even mandating the wearing of masks, probably in most cases, would not actually force a shutdown. It wouldn't have the type of restriction on the business. Now, obviously, you know, if your business is one that, and I'm trying to figure out one where the person doing the service would have to be unmasked. I'm sure there's one if I could think of it, but it's a little tough right now. I can think of a lot where the customer would need to be unmasked. I'm thinking about like a dental office here, you know, hygienist is a little bit tough to do the teeth cleaning if the mask is on. But let's say if there was something where the mask would prevent it, that'd be a different issue. But again, if it's advisory, so let's say, you know, the governor, like in Arizona, the governor is advising people to stay home, that advisory is not mandatory, and therefore it wouldn't qualify even if you decided to close your office and close the business because of that particular, request from the governor. That's a request, not an order, right? And finally, the third example is a restaurant's ordered by a local health department to close due to health code violation. Since that's not related to COVID-19, it would not be considered a government order for purposes of the ERC. So again, it's not just going to be enough that you may have a curfew ordered or you may have a, you know, some other thing that causes you to have to restrict your operations. It's got to be related to COVID-19. So COVID is part of it. Now, it also goes on and says, okay, well, we know what a government order is. What's a full or partial suspension? And they give some examples here. Like they say in question 30, if you have an order that non-essential businesses are to shut down, but essential businesses don't have to, Generally, an essential business would not be under a full or partial shutdown. Now, that kind of has to get with asterisks by it, because they will tell us later that, yeah, but if in fact you have, let's say, essential, non-essential operations, for instance, here with my firm, you know, what I'm doing today is a non-essential operation, probably. It's considered to be delivering education services, which would not be accounting services per se, and that would probably be a non-essential service. And therefore, if I'm not allowed to, and I couldn't do it from home, which would be a little tough to argue because I've done a whole bunch of it from home, but if I couldn't, then arguably, even though the business as a whole has essential components, I may have a partial shutdown. So that'd be kind of important. But again, you know, if your accounting firm does other things, and some of those were deemed non-essential, and you had an actual reduction, you know, you actually did partially shut down, then we can do this. They also clarify in question 33, if they order you to close your workplace, but you can continue operations comparable to what they did before by teleworking, then that's not considered to be a shutdown. In essence, there has to be a negative impact on the business that is significant. So if, for instance, your accounting firm, let's say you were ordered in your location to shut your office, but let's say even with the office shut, basically you continue to process things pretty much like normal, because to be totally honest, for most of us, there's not a lot of things we need to be at the office for. There are things there, but, you know, a lot of this, especially those of you who have transitioned very heavily to delivering everything to clients electronically, it's like, okay, what's the purpose of the office, right? You know, kind of in some ways. So there may be a catch, maybe it's not a huge negative impact. Flip side of that is maybe it is a huge negative impact. You know, if you're talking to do certain services, maybe you can do some of them remotely, but others can't. So again, you have to look. But if telework can fill in entirely, you're not allowed to essentially treat that as a full or partial shutdown. And they do have some examples that they go over that talk about some of the differences there, where they talk about, you know, a software development company, where we are able to do all of our development remotely. That's not going to be, even though we had to close our office, we still were able to do all the work. We've been doing it before. People telework multiple times a week, you know, but they come in the office and we're still able to work. So that really doesn't change it. Go over to a physical therapy business because we can't access the therapy equipment. That's going to be a partial shutdown, even if there are some things we could do remotely. And they talk about some other examples here with research companies, etc. And again, they also remind us, if they require you to close your workplace for certain purposes but remain open for limited operations, do you consider to have a partial suspension of operations? Answer is yes. You know, the perfect example of that, to be honest, is what I've mentioned here already about a restaurant. And that's actually the virus's first example, where the restaurant is ordered to close its dining room area, but continues to serve, you know, food through drive-through and delivery. And, you know, drive-through delivery, maybe parking lot pickup. For instance, just this morning, stopped and got breakfast at McDonald's, obviously, and I went through the drive-through. And that's been operating ever since this thing started. But that McDonald's would still be considered, under, as long as there was a mandatory order to close down that dining room, it would have been considered under a partial, you know, an order for partial suspension. Now, it, like I said, here in Phoenix, it gets interesting because once the governor removed his basic order, and on, I think it was May 13th or 14th, I can't remember which day it officially was, allowed restaurants to reopen, quote unquote, with advisory social distancing, I'd say at that point, then the McDonald's no longer is under orders, so it would lose it. But then last week, when the governor said, oh, we're making that guidance for restaurants mandatory, so that you would have to reduce your operations inside the building, now we're back to probably, again, it is a partial. So it's going to be interesting, you know, kind of juggling, and it's going to be very important to document the dates and what exactly your locality or state mandated. You know, at what point do you get it? Because that's going to make this kind of interesting. And again, remember, it doesn't matter if you got a PPP loan. They also then go on, and the IRS clarifies some things on a decline in gross receipts. The big thing they did there for decline in gross receipts was talked about for a tax-exempt organization. And it talks about gross receipts from all operations, not just unrelated trade or businesses. So essentially, whatever receipts you get in, if there's been a major decline in contributions to your organization, that would also, you know, impact you, decline in grant money. All those things could conceivably get you to where you've got the more than 50% drop, and you're going to be covered under this rule. Okay. Now, they also put in some clarifications on qualified wages, reminding you that the wages have to be Medicare or Social Security wages, essentially to qualify for this credit. So what they're telling us is right off, if you've got somebody who's exempt from Medicare and Social Security wages, for instance, we're talking here about an ordained minister, you know, even though an ordained minister, you know, is a common law employee of the church, basically, you know, these things, we got executive order, since they're not wages within the meaning of 3121A, FICA or Medicare wages, the minister's salary is not going to qualify for employee retention credit, even though you've canceled services entirely, right? And it doesn't, maybe you cancel, you're not doing anything, right? You're just shut down. It doesn't matter. That would not be qualified wages if you continue to pay them. Okay, that'd be the key issue. And you also have to worry about that. It tells you about, therefore, those wages you're going to include, like 401k deferrals. Those would still be considered part of your wages because the 401k deferral is still subject to FICA. The amounts that are deferred to a health care plan and under a cafeteria plan, you think, well, wait, that won't account. But remember, health care payments by the employer do count, and so that is treated as if it's a health care payment by the employer. We have that clarification here. They also have some additional guidance here on the use of third-party payers. And when they talk about third-party payers, they do tell us that the payroll reporting agent can sign and submit a Form 7200 on behalf of the client, and they tell you how to do that. They also tell us when the third-party payer can rely on client information regarding the employee retention credit. Generally can, but on request, they're going to have to go back and, you know, get that information from the employer, and they still could be liable for the tax if the employer is lying. So it's, you know, it's one of those issues that you have to worry about. And they also talk about the double benefit, you know, that the third party payer is not responsible for ensuring there is no double benefit claimed. It is the employer, right, their customers' requirement to ensure they're not also claiming credit under Section 45S, which is jobs credit type structures. They're not supposed to claim that and the ERC, but the payroll, you know, the third party payer does not have to worry about, you know, monitoring that. So that's what we got here for more ERC. Again, if it applies to your clients, it applies only to those that did not get a PPP loan. Next up, we did get, and this really is covering things we pretty much talked about last week, but this was the formal guidance. The Business Loan Program, Temporary Changes, Paycheck Protection Program, Revisions to Loan Forgiveness, Interim Final Rule, and SBA Loan Review Procedures, Interim and Final Rule, issued by the SBA on the 22nd of June. And this provides some, you know, just the official guidance. First thing is, it tells us about the owner, employees, and self-employed. It reminds us about that 2.5 months rule. It also makes very clear, right, if you were ever thought that somehow C corporation corporations shareholders are not owner employees, this will totally debunk that idea. In the second paragraph for the question being answered here under basically part 3.3c, the second paragraph answering the question tells us that in particular, C corporation owner employees are capped by the amount of their 2019 employee cash contributions and employee retirement health care contributions made on their behalf. S corporations are capped by or owner employees are capped by 2019 employee cash contributions and employer retirement contributions made on their behalf, but employer health care contributions made on their behalf cannot be separately added because those payments are already included in their cash contribution. Oh, by the way, yes, notice 2008-1 requires those to be on the W-2. If your clients haven't done that and you've been allowing them to get away with it, you're going to have trouble, right? Those health care costs are not going to be offsettable payroll expenses because they weren't properly reported. So, yeah, be careful there as to how that one works out. But it's very clear the 2.5 months rule is there. The SBA tells us and explains why they did it. Very simply, they did that 2.5 months rule instead of going to 24/52 of last year's compensation. When we go to 24 weeks, they said clearly it's because we do not want to allow owners to take more out than they were justified, you know, under the loan getting in, because what that would allow them to do is essentially terminate and not pay a whole bunch of other employees and just take all the money for themselves. And assuming they could meet the restoration rule by December 31st, they would enrich themselves and, you know, the employees would just be tough luck. The SBA is saying, nope, that's not what we want. So we're going to cap owner employees at the 2.5 months. In essence, what was allowed to be used to justify the loan on their behalf. And we're then going to say the rest of it has to be spent on other employees or other expenses. And remember, we still got the 60% rule for that particular issue. They cleaned up a little bit here. A lot of this is just cleaning up things, you know, going to 24 weeks. So they cleaned up and gave us on when costs must be incurred. They just clarified now and changed their example to show that it would be 24 weeks instead of 8 weeks. Same thing about when you have to pay non-payroll costs. They moved that utility example we talked about before. They just changed that now to be one that shows the example for 24 weeks, not 8. And we also got for reduction in loan forgiveness, there were two discussions here. First, they did update the prior guidance to go to 24 weeks. So we talk about that. That was prior things that it already allowed you. So we talk about when you're going to restore, you know, and the FTE test, the full-time equivalent test, the hourly wage or salary issue. They discussed all that stuff there and restoring that. The other issue is there were some new provisions under the Paycheck Protection Program Flexibility Act. And they discussed there some of their issues about both the ones where you are. We're going to talk about the employees who you can't hire back. It discusses that rule, and it's a modification of the rule. They've already mentioned this, right? It's a modification. It kind of expands a rule they had written administratively. They keep the admin rule, which is where somebody refuses unemployment, right? The offer in that, refuse an offer to be rehired. They do still require you to turn in to the state unemployment agency for that relief. But the second relief is if due to social distancing rules, requirements, or suggestions from the governor, in this case, suggestions will work, that also could justify not going back and being unable to restore operations by the end of December to what they'd been before. Now, remember, it does say by the end of December, so if your client wants to apply early for forgiveness, you really don't have this option, you know, until you can get operations restored. Because if you need the restoration of operation exception, you can't prove that, right, until we get to the point that we've actually restored operations. So, yeah, be a little, you know, that one's kind of interesting if you use it. So we get into that. They also clarify the deferral period. We talk about that, the general process for loan forgiveness. That basically is pretty much like it was before. Some minor clarifications made to how the process was going, how you get your approval. They do clarify that you can, you know, once you spent the money, you can apply, right? But if you do that, remember, if you've had a reduction in salary or a reduction in hourly rate, you have to kind of gross that up to 24 weeks, even though you paid out your amounts over 10 weeks. And we don't know yet if you restore over 24 weeks. Well, you can wait for the end of 24 weeks and see if you get the numbers back in line, or you can apply now. But if you apply now, you got to take whatever you've had to date and then kind of gross that up over the 24 weeks. My guess is the flip side of that, though, is, of course, means that if you dropped it after, you know, you run out of money, you might want to apply early because you're going to get bad results going forward, not good results. And we'll see that. And I did see the National Federation of Independent Businesses did a study and, you know, queried their members, and they did find a significant number of members planning to, you know, when they run out of the PPP money, they're saying we're going to have to lay people off again because, you know, we don't have enough work for them to keep going. And so they're expecting, you know, they said a significant portion of their membership was looking to, you know, be doing layoffs again. So it'll be interesting what happens over the next few weeks as the PPP money runs out for small businesses and see what the reaction is and if we do see an uptick in unemployment as the loan money goes away. Finally, they discussed the deferral period and forgiveness. And again, they then just remind us about the 10-month deal. You have 10 months after it. You know, you have 10 months to apply after the end of the covered period. And again, very clearly says you can apply for forgiveness at any time. So, you know, your lender, whether when lenders will be ready for it, probably be a whole different question, because I don't know that's going to be quite as simple. But it is what we have. So we've got the PPP loan program. Let's go on. We've got Section 199 Cap A because, hey, you know, we got to have some new stuff here. Previously, what we have here is some cleanup for some additional items. This is Treasury Decision 9899 issued on June the 24th. And this really just cleans up some things. It has a discussion on the treatment of previously suspended losses. It clarifies that the list found in the regulation is not an exclusive list. It's anything that gets delayed, that delays the deduction for QBI income, you know, will count under these rules. It does remind us that we make all determinations about whether it's QBI, how much is QBI, etc., in the year in which the expenses or losses incurred, not waiting for the year in which the amount is actually allowed to fly through the return. So it becomes a separate loss in a later year. And that's interesting because they also go on to explain, well, I should say, one thing they clearly added because people were all upset it wasn't the list, they did say 461L, that is the excess business loss rule that's now been deferred, but that rule would be a suspended loss under these rules. But the other big thing we get to is under this idea is they talk about disallowed losses from a specified service, trade, or business. So if you had SSTB losses deferred due to passive activity limitations or deferred due to lack of basis, lack of at risk, the key thing they talk about there is you're going to apply the threshold amount and the phase out range and the W-2, and that means therefore, and potentially W-2 wage limits, you're going to apply all of those in the year in which the loss is incurred. So let's say in the year in which you finally get to take the loss, you know, your income's way up, you're way above the threshold amount, you're still going to have negative QBI come out from that prior year if you get to deduct those losses, you know, because we look to the year you incurred it. Flip side of that is if you incur the loss in a year in which your AGI is way up and your taxable income is way up and, you know, you just don't, you know, you're not allowed to take QBI, or I should say SSTBs are totally non-QBI items, then that also would carry over even if in the later year you were clearly within the realm. So, you know, that does clarify how that would work. They also gave us some additional information, detailed information on dividends paid by a registered investment company, mutual fund. If you actually do the accounting for one of those, you want to dig into these regs, it tells you in detail how to do these. The big thing, if you don't do the accounting, what they really tell you about as a recipient, they do talk about the special rule that if you hold them for a short period, you know, right around the ex-dividend date, that you're not going to be able to pick that up. Any part of the registered investment fund, 199 Cap A dividends will not count for you, right? That's related to similar rules we have on the qualified dividend rules that have a similar level. We also got some additional guidance on trusts. We're told how to handle separate shares. They make it clear you can't. The separate share rule does apply. And if it does, you're going to separate the QBI between the two. And they go through some examples, you know, some discussions of how you do that. But you're going to allocate it between the two parties based on the, you know, DNI that's involved. They also discuss how charitable remainder trust will work. And they do point out a charitable remainder trust itself gets no deduction. Unlike most other trusts, the CRT cannot itself get a deduction because, really, it doesn't pay tax on it. But that QBI, you know, taint or that QBI factors do come out if somebody gets a taxable distribution from the fund that is considered to come from that layer that includes the QBI. And they discuss how to do it, how to divide that up among the various parties. They have some discussions there about how to get that done. So if you have a charitable remainder trust that has QBI, you know, you can take a look at this. Interesting enough, they do, though, also warn you, if you have QBI in a charitable remainder trust, you better worry about unrelated business income issues are potentially a big one that could show up. So, yeah, it's like you're not going to see that too often. But if you do, we now do know how to handle it. Okay, next thing up, we did get the parking lot tax proposed reg, REG 119-307-19, issued on June the 19th. This is going back to that infamous parking lot tax under that was added as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act under 274A4. You know, any amount an employer incurs for qualified transportation expenses that are excluded from the employee's W-2, those costs are considered to be non-deductible to the employer. Now, we got rid of the problem for not-for-profits so that they don't have to pay that extra tax, additional unrelated business income tax, but it's still there for for-profit. So the parking lot tax returns. And to a large extent, this is implementing Notice 2018-99 and gives us a couple of additional items to work with. So let's talk briefly about what's in this reg. The regs go on for quite a while. We've got them all written up in the write-up you can download. But let's talk briefly about what's in here. They are reliance proposed regulations. So the good news is you can rely on them. You can use them prior to such time as they become final. So even though they're proposed, you're allowed to continue to use them at this point. You also could instead continue to use Notice 2018-99 until those, or you could do any reasonable method. You know, you got all those things in play. This, you're going to discover, is not that different from Notice 2018-99. So my guess is it's not going to matter. I think you're going to like one of the special things we get. Now, they do go through some definitions here that are crucial. One thing to remember, under the definition of employee, partners, 2% shareholders of S corporations, sole proprietors, and independent contractors are not employees of the taxpayer. So if you have parking used by a partner, a 2% shareholder of an S corporation, a sole proprietor, independent contractor, that's not considered employer parking for this purpose. Now, the flip side of that is they technically don't qualify for the exclusion either. That's kind of bad news, but okay, that's how we go. Now, they also define parking facility, which is pretty much any place you can park a car. It can be indoor, outdoor. It can be a lot beside your building, whatever it is. And they also talk about here total parking expenses. And that pretty much like we found in Notice 2018-99, you know, it includes all of those things. It includes repairs, maintenance, utility costs, insurance, property taxes, interest, snow and ice removal, leaf removal, trash removal, cleaning, landscape costs, parking lot attendant expenses, security, and rent or lease payments, or a portion of the payments, right? If not broken out separately of the payment, right? Depreciation is still not considered to be a parking expense. So if you have a parking garage, you know, or you're talking about, you know, you've got the land improvement for the paved asphalt in your parking lot, the depreciation on that is not considered a parking expense for this purpose. So don't worry about grabbing the depreciation. They talk about the methods for calculating now. Under 2018-99, we got a single safe harbor. Now we have a number of options. When they talk about these special rules we have in this place, we have a couple of special rules first. Key one right away is a calculation of something called mixed parking expenses. Now, mixed parking expenses is the sort of thing that we've got here where you're leasing a building with a parking lot, or you own a building and there's a parking lot on it. Okay, it's considered to be that, you know, the costs involved are mixed up. So let's say a simple case of a lease. I'm leasing an office building. I'm paying, you know, $12,000 a month for my lease, and I get parking. You know, I get to use the parking lot that's with the building. Great. How much of that is considered to be, how much of that rent cost is considered to be for the parking lot? Well, they give us two choices here now in this calculation. We can use a, quote, reasonable method to allocate, which is what we had before, and everybody's like, I have no idea what that is. Or basically, you can use 5% of the following expenses and treat them as that: lease or rental agreement expenses, property taxes, interest expense, and expenses for utility and insurance related to the utilities, et cetera, related to the parking lot. My guess is we're going to see a lot of people go for the 5% of all the basic expenses here instead of going to try to figure out something else that it may just not make much difference and it's not worth spending tons of time on. So we'll use 5%. So don't be surprised if you see that kind of become the default. Also, they tell us that if we have what are considered to be multiple facilities that are adjacent. Now, here's where it gets weird, what adjacent means. Adjacent means that, A, I could own two separate lots that literally are touch each other, right? You know, they're touching each other. Great. You know, the border of one, we have a border that's, you know, the lot ends and the next lot begins immediately after over that border. Or it could be a lot across the street. So I could have a lot across the street here from my office. If we were leasing that lot across the street, let's say right to use that lot across the street from us, in the office building across the street, don't know why we'd do it, but let's say we did, That could also be considered adjacent if we took the one directly across the street from our building, because it would be adjacent. It would touch, quote, touch, ignoring the road it would touch. But it doesn't count if they are basically diagonal and touch only at the corner. I don't know why that makes a difference, but it does. So if for some reason we were to lease a parking lot, and we're not really on a corner, but if we were on the corner and we were to lease the parking lot that was on the other side of the road, you know, on the other side of, let's say we're at an intersection, it was the one diagonally across that intersection, that one could not be aggregated. We'd have to test the lot separately. That's also one of the quirks we've got. Okay, then they give us calculation methods. And if you pay, now some of this is pretty simple. If you actually, let's say, pay a parking garage, right? So I've got a parking garage, it costs, you know, $200 a month to park there for each space, or $300 or whatever it is. You know, if I take that $200 a month payment, that's what I use. Whatever that amount is, I just take that. That is the amount per, you know, per space. So I'm paying a third party directly for per space. That's easy. They're providing parking. A lot of entities that are, let's say, in a downtown location will probably do that. You know, they will just pay a rate at a parking garage somewhere near their building, and they'll just pay for people to be at that lot. And so that will be your parking expenses for those employees. If, however, it's not that, if you've got an owned, it's a lot that you either own or lease, then your options are a set of them, okay? And what we're going to talk for there, we're going to talk about third-party parking. Now, for general or lease facilities, here's a couple of ways we can do it. Now, there are some things. You can use a general rule, okay? The general rule says that, you know, you can pretty much come up with a reasonable method, but there are some things that aren't considered reasonable. You cannot use the value of the parking to the employee to determine the expense. So I don't care that somebody a lot next door to you sells it at whatever per day, $20 per day. You can't just say $20 per day is what we're going to disallow. You can't do that. You must not deduct expenses related to reserved employee spaces. This comes throughout the issue. If you have spaces that in your lot are reserved for a particular employee or class employees that only be used by employees, are not available to the general public, you absolutely have to, you know, remove the cost of those, right? And you cannot, you know, you cannot imply the exception improperly for qualified parking made available to the public. You know, you got to say you can't treat that as says, oh, it's open to the public, which is going to be an exception, merely because the general public has access to the facility. That's not going to be good enough to make it go. We're going to talk about whether it's actually open for their use, not because every so often they have some access to parts of it, right? You know, that's going to be the key. Just because they could drive into it isn't going to do it. Now, for all three methodologies, we do have something that comes up called the peak demand period. And you can look at that to determine when's the largest number of employees in your lot. That's going to be how you're going to determine the percentage of spaces in use. And you do get to exclude the overlap that might exist if you have a change of shifts. You know, so if you have two shifts, obviously, you know, both shifts, a lot of employees from both shifts will be a lot of overlap during the time you've got a change of shift as people come in and take over. So you can ignore that. You can just look at, you know, your shifts in question and what's the largest shift for peak demand. So we start working with this. Now, there are some options here. Your options, if you don't want to use the general rule, is you can just use the qualified parking limit. Take the number of spaces used by employees during the peak period or the total number of your employees, if you don't want to figure that other thing, and multiply it by the limit on exclusion, which is $270 for 2020 for each month in the year. And that'll determine your exclusion. That has an advantage of being very simple, but, you know, it's probably going to be higher than in a lot of cases it would come to otherwise. The other catch is you do have to determine if the value to the employee is more than 270, you still have to put that excess in their W-2. This doesn't allow you to ignore what that value would be. The value of that parking is greater than 270. Let's say it's in downtown Manhattan. It probably is greater than 270 to be able to park a car with a reserved space for a whole month. You're going to have to add that difference back in. You can't just use 270. The next option is basically in 2018-99, which is the primary use methodology. The primary use methodology is that four-step option. And again, The big issue there is if, in fact, most of the lot aside, you know, you first deal with the reserved, then you look at the lot's use overall. If the lot is available and used by the public, and over half the spaces, at when you consider peak use by employees, if over half the spaces are available to the public, then you essentially can ignore this whole thing. And that obviously is going to be big if you have a decent sized parking lot, you don't have a whole lot of employees, it can work if you're a retailer. If you're a manufacturer or you're a wholesaler, it's probably not going to work as well that way. Now, you know, here it is. Remember, if you own or lease parking space in a multi-tenant building, the term general public includes employees, partners, 2% shareholders of S corporations, sole proprietors, independent contractors, clients or customers of unrelated tenants in the building, right? You know, it does not include individuals that are employees, partners, 2% shareholders of the S corporation, sole proprietors, or independent contractors of a taxpayer. But it does mean that if you have a multi-tenant building, you're probably going to find that unless you are a huge portion of that building, that in fact, you're going to find out most of the lot is used by the general public because you get to count everybody else in the building as general public. So for instance, you know, if I'm thinking about the Arizona Society of CPAs office, they lease space in an office building that has a lot of other tenants in it. They would not be considered, you know, their parking, you know, in their case, in that scenario, think about that for those of you here in Arizona, you know, that'd be a case where if that was your CPA firm sitting in there, yeah, you're fine. The parking that everybody else in the building uses, even if it's all used up by employees of another company in the building, it doesn't matter. It's still going to be general public for you. Total parking spaces mean parking spaces, the portion in the parking facility, if it's limited. Reserve spaces, they talk about that. And reserve non-employees, if there's some marking that's only customers can do it. Available takes away reserved employee spaces, less unusable spaces, and those sorts of things. That's what it means. We get into that kind of background. Okay. Finally, we also can do, instead of that, you know, $270 per space, you can figure out the total cost and use a cost per space test. So if you want to do that, then you could just do it, figure out max use by employees, do cost per space, and go down that route. Any one of those three will work. Remember, use by the general public is really kind of the big issue, if we can get that to work. That's kind of our big advantage. And that one goes back, and you still can use that, so understand how it works. They talk a little bit about some of the exceptions you can do, but also talk about the expenses for a commuter highway vehicle and transit pass. They talk about that issue, right, how that goes and how you pick that up. Again, the exceptions under 274A4, if it's to the extent it is treated as compensation, but there definitely are limitations on that. If you have any qualified transportation fringe and it's made available to the general public, that's the exception for the parking lot that generally the public's allowed to use over half of. Right, if you've got that, or if you, let's say, did have a commuter highway vehicle, but you go ahead and you pick up anybody for all the businesses in your area, anybody that wants to commute in can ride it, good, that'll be fine. Or if you actually sell the item to the public, that also makes it into a public use thing and you can exclude there. They also remind you that commuting expenses, they have the discussion there because the law provides that commuting expenses are essentially, are disallowed for deduction. If the expense is treated by the taxpayer on the federal income tax return as compensation, not treated in that case. Let's talk about this. I've got to find the one for commuting. When we talk about the general commuting expense rules, most deductions for commuting benefits expenditures are denied to the taxpayer unless it is for the safety of the employee. Okay. So that's one. I know a lot of you probably think that this is an overblown thing. And yeah, but if you're ever worried about it, we got it. Now, the other big thing this week was the issuance of the CARES Act Special Rollover Rules, known as 2020-51, issued on June the 23rd. Remember, it turns out we don't have to take required minimum distributions in 2020, but we didn't find that out until March. And some of our clients were on monthly payment schemes for their RMDs. And some of them were inherited IRAs on monthly payment schemes. So, yeah, we're just kind of in problems. So either we couldn't roll over because it was inherited, we couldn't roll over because it's been more than 60 days, or because we'd received three payments, the one rollover per year rule is going to kill us for rollovers. Even if we were with, even for those within 60 days, we could only pick one of the three payments checks we'd received. So that was a problem. Well, we got a special rule here. As long as you put the money back by August 31st, it's going to be considered to be fine, right? That includes inherited IRAs. They go back into the same account. Just return the money, right, in the inherited IRA. Put it back in there. If you return it there by August the 31st, even if you got 32 payments, doesn't matter. All of them have to go in, can go back in by August 31st. You're fine, included for inherited IRAs. And we don't worry about the once every 12-month rule. We're just treating it as repaying. We're ignoring that. Now, can the IRS do that? I think a lot of people say officially no, based on their history, the position they've always taken. Is anybody going to challenge it? Probably not. But nevertheless, yeah, it is what we're doing. Plans will have to be amended. There is a sample plan amendment there for employee retirement plans, because they're going to have to be amended to take the money back in for the rollover. There are going to be some issues, so there is that sample plan amendment. There also are a number of other issues that are discussed in Q&As that came with this. Some of the odd things that came up there, for instance, let's say that you have to choose, this is the time you're supposed to choose in 2020 between a 5-year or 1-year payout. If dad died last year, dad was under 70 and a half, so we're still under the old 5-1-year rule. You had to choose. You got to take the 1-year distribution this year, the life expectancy distribution for your life expectancy this year, and then you could stretch it out over the entire period, or you could wait and take it at the end of 5 years. Well, they clarify that because of the suspension of RMDs, you actually have till the end of next year to decide if you want to do it over the life expectancy. So it gives you a little more time. It also says that, we do get non-spouse beneficiaries are able to do the rollovers. If you've got a non-spouse designated beneficiary, they can do the rollovers in the qualified plan. It does not affect your required beginning date. We just don't have to take the payment this year, but you're still in the RMD. So that means if somebody, which I don't know how, well, I guess in a plan you could, maybe if it was going to be amended. But if you hit your required beginning date, you still are treated as hitting your required beginning date this year. It's not as if you got to wait, you got a year later. So you're going to use the same tables, et cetera, that you would have as if you had taken the 2020 distribution. All of those things, we have those issues. They remind you that this does not cover every deadline that exists. You got to realize it's a limited number of options that are covered by this. It does discuss conditions under which a spousal consent may need to be obtained, depending on what's happening if you're paying out from a defined contribution plan. Remember, this does not affect defined benefit plans. Defined benefit plans are not excused from this, only defined contribution plans. But if you are, you may need to get a new spousal consent. That's question 7. You can look at that. The plan is not allowed to treat this as one that has mandatory withholding. So you have to give the employee a choice if they want withholding or not from the distribution if they take one out this year. And it does. And the other catch is, while it won't blow a substantially equal payment distribution, if you take extra, we found out under the CARES distribution, they also tell us, though, flat out here, that you're not going to be able to skip your payment this year if you're under the substantially equal payment methods to avoid the premature distribution tax until you get to age 59 and a half. That payment still has to come out this year. That's under question 10. The proper amount has to come out, so be careful there. Right? That's going to be the case in this case. And it also reminds us, in question 12, even if you have like a cash balance plan, where you're counting your distributions as if, it was a single account plan, to determine your distribution for an RMD. The fact it's a defined benefit plan means you cannot skip it. Even if it looks like a defined contribution because you've got a cash balance structure and the distributions look like a defined contribution plan to the employee, they're not. And therefore, you have to go ahead and treat this under the defined benefit plan distributions also go out. They can't skip it this year. So that is important in that realm. Finally, we got an interesting lesson in the tax law. IRS posted a notice on their website, IRS Statement of Interest Payments, IRS website. It was posted on June the 24th. And it deals with payment of interest on refunds. And what it tells us is interest will be paid on refunds for the period from April 15th of 2020 until July 15th of 2020. Any return filed by July 15th will go ahead and get interest all the way back to April 15th, and it'll get interest through the date that the amount is paid. Now, they're not saying if we still get that interest if you go on extension. I think you may not. I think it may be that you're going to give up. Now, it's not going to be a huge amount of interest because we're at 5% and 3% for the period, but nevertheless, it is interest. And why did this happen? Well, it's actually in the law. Section 7508C, 7508 cap AC governs overpayments, and 7508 cap AC is what the IRS used to delay the payments. That was what is triggered by the declaration of an emergency by the president. And it tells us to go look at 7508B for this purpose. 7508 is delays that are allowed for people serving in combat zones. And what that rule does, the special rules there do a couple of things. First thing is, normally you don't get interest on a refund, even if you have a refund due, until you ask the IRS, file a return asking for the refund, the IRS does not have to start computing interest. So there's no interest, you know, at that point until there. So we don't worry about anything before the date the return was filed. And the IRS doesn't have to pay any interest if they pay within 45 days of the date of the deemed filing. So they skip it entirely. 7508B, which is referenced by 7508 cap AC, gets rid of both of those rules. So that means interest starts on April the 15th, and it runs all the way through July the 15th, even if the IRS deposits your refund in your account, you know, within minutes of you electronically filing the return, which not likely to do, but if they did, you're still got to get interest. Now, they do warn you, and this is going to be important because your client's going to call. I know they're going to call. That interest payment may be separate from the refund. My guess is the service does not yet know for sure if they can get this all incorporated and get the computers reprogrammed to pay this interest on a timely fashion. And if they can't, well, then we're going to have a little fun with this, right? We're kind of stuck. So anyway, we'll see. But that means clients will be calling asking, I just got a check for $27.32. Why'd I get it? You got it because it's interest on your refund. I never got that before. I know you never got it before. It's a special rule this year. Don't worry about it. Okay. So that's coming up. So do be aware those interest payments are coming. Right. And again, all of these are discussed in much more details in our articles, which by the way, this week, the articles ran for a lot more pages. I mean, we had a lot of things happen this week. I got a 59 pages of material. That if you want to go read through the details, they're all there in the 59 pages. You can read them. Have fun. So we got lots happening this week. Now, remember, as I told you last week, if you're in New Jersey, or you're a member of the New Jersey CPAs, NJCPA, I'm going to be doing a society monthly tax update again on July 22nd. All of this stuff today we'll discuss in a bit more detail, plus other things that have happened. So we have lots of things to talk about. That's going to be our four-hour monthly update. So if you're able to, you want to sign up, it's available on New Jersey NJCPA website. Check it for July the 22nd. I'll be presenting the update. And if you want to sign up, it's able to be signed up for now. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week. Again, you can catch regular updates at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I also, if you want questions or comments, you can send them to edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle, you can follow me on Twitter @edzollers. I'm a member of the State Society Connect groups for Arizona, New Jersey, Illinois, Minnesota, Washington. Get all my groups together. So I do look in those if questions come up. I also do from time to time look into the Reddit group at /r/taxbros. So if you have issues, you can check there and see what's up. Otherwise, hey, we're heading to July. The last PPP loan date is Tuesday. So if you're listening to this after Tuesday, it's July. PPP loans are no longer going to be issued unless Congress does something to extend them. So be aware of that. We're coming up on that date. So I don't know if that's good news or bad news, but at least we won't get new loans out there. I suppose for those of us having to deal with it, that's good news. We've got the number under control, at least for the moment, although there is talk right now of expanding the program. Take care. Get ready. Remember, July 15th is around the corner. There are discussions. You know, the Secretary of Treasury has mentioned that he might extend the deadline. He's thinking about maybe considering it. It's interesting. TPAs I talked to, it's kind of fun. They seem to be divided right down the middle. Some of them say, no way, don't do it. It's a disaster. Tax season needs to end. And others are saying, no, push it back. So I don't know. Keep your eyes open, but we may have another delay coming. Just be aware of that. But if we do, we'll be back here next week to tell you what we know. And I'm going to say, hopefully, if there is another delay, they do get it out, you know, right at the 1st of July. Don't wait till like July 12th to tell us they're going to do it. But join us back here next week. We'll go over brand new updates and what's happening in current federal tax developments.